Hey everyone, I'm Simmer, a student at Harvard University.
And I'm Roger, a student at King's College London.
And this is That Medic Podcast. In this podcast, we spoke to Dr. Sachin Jain, President and CEO of the Scan Group and Health Plan. We discussed his transition from the federal government to the pharmaceutical industry, his previous work leading healthcare systems, and how we can more emphatically move U.S. healthcare toward value-based care. Today's show is perfect for anyone excited about healthcare leadership or just intrigued about the future of medicine. So without further ado, let's have a listen. So hi, Dr. Jain. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for taking the time out to speak with us. So we normally start the podcast by asking the question, why did you decide to study medicine?
It's a complicated question. So it's a complicated answer. You know, why did I decide to study medicine? I grew up around medicine. We had many physicians in my family, most notably my father, who was the founding chief of the pain service at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And, you know, this idea of living a career in service of others through clinical care, you know, mentoring the next generation through education and producing new knowledge through research seemed interesting to me. But I will say it was not a predetermined or predestined path in that I have clear recollections of going home from college. And the conversation with my dad went a little bit like this. I said, Dad, you know, I really am very interested in the law. And he said, you know, that's great. You know, you should really do law school after you go to medical school. And so, you know, there's a little bit of family expectation mingled in there, but it was obviously something I was familiar with because I grew up around it. And I was compelled to think about, you know, patient care, both from a one-on-one patient interaction perspective, but also think about how I could think about broader systemic change, really inspired by my dad's two sisters, Ganthi Jain and Shanti Jain, both of whom had careers as a scientist and a physician, respectively, both of whom were trying to solve bigger picture problems in society, you know, in addition to, you know, kind of dealing with micro level issues. And so I think family influence has a lot to do with it, as, you know, as it continues to have for many individuals.
Certainly. And although you didn't go to law school, I know that you did start your career after medical school in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. So I'm really curious, can you tell me a little bit about what attracted you to public service?
When I was a Harvard undergraduate, I was trying to think about, you know, how to have kind of broad impact in society, but also have a professional identity as a physician. And I wasn't really sure how I might do that until I took a course that I think is still offered. Maybe it has a different title now. At the time, it was called Gen Ed 186, and it was Quality of Healthcare in America. And it was co-taught by Don Berwick and Howard Hyatt. And until I met Don and Howard, had no idea, you know, kind of how I might be able to merge a career in trying to create systemic change as well as clinical medicine. And both Don and Howard had incredible careers working at the interface of clinical medicine and health policy. And they really gave me a template to think about. From that point forward, I knew I really wanted to try to impact, you know, U.S. healthcare policy as well as practice clinically. And but then along the way, I kind of had this realization that health policy actually moves very slowly. You know, when you look at the history of health policy, there's a slow pace of change punctuated by kind of big acts of Congress. And so I actually diverted. I ended up getting an MBA in between my third and fourth year of medical school and thought I was going to be an academic physician working at the interface of business and medicine. And was actually joint faculty at the business school at Harvard, as well as a resident at Brigham and Women's Hospital. And then, you know, a guy named Barack Obama, senator from Illinois, got elected president. And all of a sudden, health policy was the topic. And so I actually took a leave from my residency to go and notified a bunch of, you know, kind of mentors and people I had admired who were rumored to be going to government as part of the Obama administration. And told them I'd be happy to carry their bags down with them to Washington as long as they would give me a job. And the first person who called was David Blumenthal, and he offered me a position as his special assistant. So I began working as David Blumenthal's special assistant at the Office of the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology. And then subsequently, when my old college professor, Don Berwick, was appointed CMS administrator, he asked me to be part of the founding team at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. So I spent a year doing that with Don. Then I ended up, I had a decision. I could either continue my government career or I could go back to residency to finish my residency. And so I went back to finish my residency at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. And that's kind of my journey to the federal government.
So as I mentioned briefly, this summer I'm actually working within CMS in the Office of Minority Health. So I'm really interested in your role as a founding member of CMMI, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. Could you share a little bit about your work there, especially as it relates to payment reform?
Yeah, I mean, the center when I joined was really just a few pages of the Affordable Care Act. It was Section 3021, two pages, and kind of laid out a few kind of guidelines around what the center would be and how it would work and how it would be funded. And I was Don's first selection to join the team at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. And I worked with a small group of people to stand the center up. You know, we had to do things like set a strategy, hire founding staff, find a permanent director. And I was intimately involved with all of that and led the search that ultimately culminated in Rick Gilfillan being named the founding director of Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. So it's an incredible time and probably the most fulfilling, you know, 2-year period of my career.
That's incredible. And I know that you have a really interesting career trajectory in that after you left CMS, you joined the pharmaceutical company Merck as their chief medical information and innovation officer. So this transition is incredibly intriguing because I know that you held pretty firm anti-pharma attitudes throughout medical school. So what changed and how did you end up at Merck?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that they were like firmly anti-pharma. What I would say is that they were any physician who trained in Boston in the 1990s or 2000s, we were influenced by a lot of the academic work coming out of the Wildwood Medical area that really focused on high cost of drugs that produced incremental value for patients. That was the narrative about biopharma at the time. And many of us bought into that narrative. You know, I was compelled to join Merck after my residency. So there was a tour of duty back at the Brigham, finishing my residency after I was in government, and then subsequently was looking for where I could work. And coming out of the government, you know, where you have an impact on sort of a healthcare organization that has reach into 50 states and hundreds of millions of people, you start to think about how can you continue to have that kind of impact at scale. And so I thought leaving the government and finishing my residency that I would work at the health system level. But on some level, that felt small coming out of the federal government. And I started to think a little bit about painting on a broader canvas and what that might look like. And at that point, I met a guy named Mike Rosenblatt, who was chief medical officer at Merck & Company. And he was looking for someone to join his team to lead digital health and data innovation for the company. And it was his second tour of duty at Merck after being dean of Tufts Medical School, as well as president of the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. And Mike was this incredibly compelling person. And he convinced me that a platform like Merck had reach into 150 countries and whose products really touched not millions of people, but potentially billions of people. And I thought that was pretty compelling. And so I found myself working for Merck largely based on the charisma and greatness of Mike Rosenblatt, who, you know, continues to be a great friend and mentor, even as we both have since moved on from Merck. So I was really attracted to the organization because of the person. But ultimately, what you realize when you kind of work in the pharmaceutical industry is that there are certain problems in American healthcare that can only be solved through biopharma innovation. And we saw that on display front and center in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic, where companies mobilized to solve ultimately what many thought was an insoluble problem in, frankly, kind of record speeds, at breathtaking speeds. So the point I'm making is there is a role for every stakeholder in the healthcare ecosystem. Now, the question of how all these pieces fit together and how they work is something for us to continue to explore. But I will say I have a very different perspective on the biopharmaceutical industry, having worked in it, than I did kind of coming up through the Harvard Medical System as a trainee. And I'm super glad that my perspective has been broadened, you know, since then.
Yeah, I was just about to mention that it seems like by engaging different components of the healthcare system, you're really expanding your perspective of how it functions and the importance of all the different components. And after Merck, of course, you then shifted towards leading healthcare systems with CareMore and then Aspire Health. So I'm really curious what those roles consisted of and what are you most proud of during that time?
So CareMore was a tremendous organization. I mean, it was founded by a visionary physician named Dr. Sheldon Zinberg in the 90s. And the goal of it was to introduce new models of care that focused on caring for the sickest of the sick patients. And Zinberg eventually transitioned leadership of the company to a woman named Leva Lessin, who led the company for 10 years. And then she transitioned leadership of the organization to me. You know, long before there was an Iora Health or a ChenMed or an Oak Street, there was a CareMore. And the focus at CareMore was intensive management of chronic disease and the continuity of care across all sites of care through a model called the extensivist model, which is making sure, you know, very simply, just that the same physician who takes care of you in the hospital takes care of you in post-acute rehab and post-follow-up discharge to ensure that there's a high degree of continuity of care and care planning and that relationships are leveraged to improve the health of patients. Now, there's a whole lot more to the organization than those two concepts, but those were the kind of core tenets around which the organization was built. And I was lucky to participate in leading the organization, you know, first as its chief medical officer, then as its CEO over a 5.5 year period, and led the growth of the organization from 4 states to 12 states. I led the integration and acquisition of Aspire Health, and also presided over, you know, the creation of new programs, including things like applying ride sharing to provide, you know, non-emergency medical transportation to seniors. We built some of the first clinical programs in loneliness in the country, and we built up one of the largest hospital at home programs in the country. We adapted the CareMore model from serving, you know, just Medicare patients to Medicaid patients as well. So, you know, just had a tremendously creative and formative period of my career.
And I mean, that all sounds incredible. Speaking more broadly, your career trajectory is fascinating. It's characterized by several significant directional shifts from government to pharma to healthcare administration to honestly, who knows where next? So that's in contrast, of course, with what you see many physicians doing, namely sticking closely to one specific track, whether that be in academia or elsewhere. So there's a few interesting points that I wanted to ask you about. Firstly, why have you reinvented yourself in various different arenas of the healthcare system, as opposed to, for example, staying firmly in one? And secondly, do you think there has been an opportunity cost to not focusing all your energy in one aspect of the healthcare system?
What I would say is, you know, reinvention is a great word. And if you don't reinvent, I think you become stale. And I also think healthcare is a field where there's high degrees of intersectionality that are oftentimes go underappreciated and underexploited. And I think a lot of my career has been about trying to ensure that we're doing the most that we can with that intersectionality. And that comes from deep knowledge having been gained, you know, kind of operating in each one of these places. The experiences that I've had have been very dense. Merck, we executed 14 different digital health and data partnerships over the course of my 3 years there. You know, my time at CareMore was characterized by rapid growth, innovation, differentiation. And I actually think, you know, organizations get stale when their leaders are in place for too long. And I think people get stale when they're in place for too long. So I think it's actually been a tremendously, you know, valuable and highly accretive, you know, period of my career and life.
I also, of course, want to talk about your current role as CEO of the Scan Health Plan, which is a nonprofit health maintenance organization in Southern California, founded in 1977. So what makes Scan different from most other healthcare organizations? And what exactly is your role within Scan?
Scan was founded with the goal of keeping seniors healthy and independent. It was founded by a racially and gender diverse group of community activists who believed that aging had a broken status quo in the United States. It was called the Senior Care Action Network. And today, Senior Care Action Networks, also known as SCAN, serves over 220,000 individuals, primarily in the state of California, but with goals to expand to new geographies, as well as to introduce new models of care. You know, it's been a tremendous year that I've been there. We're aggressively focused on growth, innovation, and diversification We'll have a presence in new states starting this fall. You know, we will be diversifying from primarily delivery of care through Medicare Advantage, through direct provision of care to populations. We're introducing, you know, new palliative care programs. We have new programs to reduce, you know, racial disparities in health. So lots underway.
Incredible. And I know that one key aspect of SCAN is the notion of value-based care. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more to that. And also, in your opinion, why has the U.S. been so slow to shift away from fee-for-service and towards value-based care?
Yeah, I mean, value-based care is a fancy word of saying we're just trying to get the most for our healthcare dollar. And the challenge that we've had is that U.S. healthcare, the dirty little secret of U.S. healthcare is that we just have a steadily inflating cost base where there's been very little pressure to reduce costs. Other industries, competition reduces costs. In healthcare, we cap the number of clinicians that are produced every year, as well as the number of institutions that can provide care, either through hard or soft regulatory constraints. So competition is not really able to do what it can do. And what value-based care ultimately aims to do, whether it's in the U.S. or abroad, is give a fixed budget to an entity that is then required to manage healthcare costs within the constraint. And what we've seen time and time again is that that approach works. It comes with trade-offs. You know, you can't be all things to all people, or, you know, continue to operate wide networks that provide unlimited access to unlimited services. But, you know, what we see is that the future is here. It's just unevenly distributed. And California has long had a great history of value-based clinical care delivery. And the rest of the country, I think, is largely catching up to what I discovered when I moved out here, you know, 7 years ago. So, you know, I think the opportunity is for the nation to start to look more and more like groups of people who take global responsibility for the care of populations of patients and doing the best they can within these global budgets.
You know, it's really interesting because value-based care just seems so intuitive, the idea of cutting costs and improving quality. But in many ways, we're still predominantly in this fee-for-service model. I wanted to talk to you also about the healthcare value chain, which for our listeners at home is a structure that connects purchasers to fiscal intermediaries, to providers, to product intermediaries, to producers. SCAN is an integrated health plan. So I'm really curious how you have worked to ensure value at every part of the chain.
Look, you know, at the end of the day, what is value? Value is, you know, using the might that you have in the marketplace to get the best deal for the end user. And that is what we try to do every day for our patients, is purchase healthcare for them in ways that gives them the best healthcare experience at the lowest cost. And, you know, I think everyone tries to do that. I spent my morning actually working on employee health benefits. And you realize that, you know, one of the great pathologies in our thinking about U.S. healthcare is our failure to embrace trade-offs. You know, we don't always acknowledge that if we buy more of X, then we should, you know, buy less of Y. Best example of that, I would say, is just the continued American kind of perception that everyone should have access to as broad a network of care as possible. That might be great from an access perspective, but from a cost management perspective, it sometimes creates untenable dynamics. And so, you know, my passion leading health, both for our SCAN employees as well as for the patients, is trying to see how can we get more for people, you know, for less. That's the goal. And that's the work. And it's what I was taught by my mentors, most prominently Leva Lessin, who is CareMore. This is a business that's all about squeezing pennies out of the cost equation, you know, and dollars. But sometimes we get lost and we don't realize that it's about taking every piece of the value chain, whether it's your non-emergency medical transportation benefits or your fitness benefits or your drug costs or your hospital costs or your physician costs, and doing what you can to shave as much cost from the system as possible. Now, of course, unit price is one way to affect costs. Quantity of services, you know, is also another way. And the way the insurance industry has historically managed quantity is through utilization management. But what I learned from my time at CareMore that I apply to my work, you know, going forward, is the best way to avoid healthcare costs is to be healthier. And so I think at the end of the day, our job as healthcare organizations is to figure out what are the investments that we need to make on the front end to make people healthier. Now, one of the challenges in non-Medicare domains of healthcare is that, you know, people tend to change health plans every year, you know, based on changing jobs, or every other year, or whatever the average tenure is. So those long-term investments don't tend to make sense. You know, you know, Medicare, fortunately, when somebody chooses a Medicare Advantage plan after they've been on it for a year, they're likely to pass on that same plan. So you can make those kinds of longer-term investments. But people are Medicare eligible unless they're disabled after the age of 65. And that's a long time to wait, frankly, to begin to work on keeping healthier, you know, people healthier. And so I think the broad answer requires decoupling health insurance from employment, having longer enrollment periods than just annual enrollment periods. That's the stuff that's, you know, the fundamental types of reforms that we need to create the kind of movement that we need to see.
It's all really fascinating. And I guess that gets into my next question, that what future of healthcare do you envision in the next 15 to 20 years? And if partisan gridlock means 15 to 20 years is not enough time for this kind of reform, how about 25 to 50 years?
Look, I think we're heading into a major cost crisis in U.S. healthcare. And, you know, you see it showing up everywhere, and you see every organization trying to figure out how is it going to lead the fundamental cost reengineering needed to actually drive costs to a sustainable place. And, you know, to do that, we have to start asking basic and fundamental questions, both at the micro and the macro level, both at the level of individual clinical decision making, as well as at the level of policy, to think broadly about how do we reduce total cost of care. Now, you know, I said that the future is here, it's just unevenly distributed. There are medical groups, healthcare organizations all across the country that do better at some of these things. So the question is how do we take the outcomes from the best performing groups and diffuse them to the lowest performing group? This is a fundamental question Don Berwick has been asking throughout his career. Is how do we reduce local area variation in quality and cost of care? So this is the stuff that I've been trying to problem solve. And, you know, there are no easy answers. And I think the problem for people who work in this space is that we look for easy answers. But I think the answer, the longer term answer, is going to be through changing our culture of care, through embracing trade-offs, and frankly, unleashing the power of competition. And I think risk delegated to provider groups is one way to do that. So anyways, lots of shop talk here, but that's where I think the answers really lie.
That's awesome. And I think that nearly wraps up the episode. But before we go, could we ask for your three pieces of advice for students interested in a career in medicine?
Always stay clinical, no matter what you do. Always stay close to the patient. The patient is what brings us to work every day. Easy to forget the patient if you don't see the patient. Number two, I would say recognize that you operate in a complex system. And the more you understand the system, the better equipped you're going to be able to use the system, leverage the system to produce great outcomes for patients. And number three, take risks. If you're in medicine, you have this foundation of knowledge and information that is going to serve you well for your whole career. But it also guarantees that you'll always have a job if you need one. And so there are opportunities within that for you to pursue risk in service of others and for the benefit of others. And I think that's the opportunity.
That's incredible. Thank you so much, Dr. Jane, for coming on the show. Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Make sure to subscribe, rate us, and leave a review. You can also head to the description of this podcast to follow us on all social media so that you don't miss out on any of our content.